Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly podcast. We provide perspectives on leadership. Today, we're excited to have Eric Siegel. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Sue. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. I'm so happy to have you. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Eric is a leading consultant and former Columbia University professor who helps companies deploy machine learning. He is the founder of the long-running Machine Learning Week conference series and his new sister, Gen AI Application Summit, the instructor of the acclaimed online course, Machine Learning Leadership and Practice, End-to-End Mastery, executive editor of the Machine Learning Times, and a frequent keynote speaker. Eric wrote the best-selling book, Predictive Analytics, The Power to Predict Who Will Click, Buy, Lie, or Die, which has been used in courses at hundreds of universities, as well as his newest book, The AI Playbook, Mastering the Rare Art of Machine Learning Deployment. Eric's interdisciplinary work bridges the stubborn technology business gap. At Columbia, he won the Distinguished Faculty Award when teaching the graduate computer science courses in ML and AI. Later, he served as a business school professor at UVA's Goodarden School, and he also has published many op-eds on analytics and social justice. So, really glad to have you here. I just found out you're just in Marin, and here I'm in the city, so we're close by.
Yeah.
So I always start with the same question. We have done this for 15 years, I think, every month. And tell us about your personal journey. I read your bio, but how has that personal journey influenced to write the book, The AI Playbook?
Well, I've been in the field of machine learning for more than 30 years. And as you mentioned, my previous life as a Columbia professor, before that, I got my PhD. I taught the graduate level courses in AI and machine learning. I've been an independent consultant for more than 20, running the conference series Machine Learning Week, previously Predictive Analytics World, since 2009. And I've always, in addition to being a technical practitioner, I've always had a great interest in making the subject matter accessible to non-technical readers, mm-hmm. to business readers, and newcomers, right? Including back when I was a professor, I would teach the intro to computer science course and even the intro for poets, as it were, right? The elective science course.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And continuing very much with my first book, Predictive Analytics, my new book, The AI Playbook. And predictive analytics is really another word for enterprise applications of machine learning. And machine learning is learning from data to predict. And it's always what I've been most interested in as a core technology. Mm-hmm. My new book, AI Playbook, does continue with that tradition of like, hey, how accessible, relevant, and yet concrete and specific can we get in a way that's still interesting, engaging, and mm-hmm. totally accessible to any business reader? But it turns out this time there's a different mission behind that besides just sort of wanting to be a pop science writer and make it what I think is the most interesting kind of science accessible to everybody. Beyond that, there's a mission because it turns out that the majority of new machine learning projects are failing to reach deployment. And I strongly believe that that's primarily because of a lack of connection between the tech and biz, between the data mm-hmm. scientists, the quants, mm-hmm. the number crunching, people who are operating the actual machine learning software and preparing the data for it, et cetera. And the business professionals, people involved with the project, the people maybe who are managing the operations meant to be improved with a predictive model by the predictions that are output from machine learning.
Right.
And that because there's this disconnect, which is largely because there's a certain semi-technical ramp up that we need for the non-data science world so that everyone can be on the same page, so that everyone can engage in a deeply collaborative practice across the project's life cycle mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. inception to deployment and thereafter. And I believe that that's the root cause behind the vast majority of what we're seeing with these failed deployments, where the project has solid foundation of number crunching. There, the data scientists create a predictive model from the data that's sound, but it doesn't get deployed. So, and to put it another way, when business stakeholders don't get their hands dirty, their feet get cold. So there needs to be a concrete, semi-technical, very accessible, relevant, pertinent Totally understandable understanding of what it means to integrate predictions into large scale operations. And so in addition to sort of what I've always been doing for decades now of like, let's make this stuff accessible. Now there's a real particular need for that,
right?
Because we're kind of running on fumes of hype right now. Everyone's so excited about the core technology. It's like being more excited about the rocket science than the launch of the rocket, right? And if you're a rocket scientist, that may very well be the case. And I know that as a data scientist, I got into the field for probably very much the same reason as many or most data scientists. Machine learning is the coolest science. The idea of learning from data to garner generalizations that hold on unseen cases. And in that way, the machine has automatically actually learned something that's true and that holds in general from whatever limited number of examples it had to train on, the training data. That's such cool rocket science, if you will. So it's easy to get excited about that and be like, you know, this is cool stuff. Who cares if we actually ever launch the rocket? Maybe next week, you know. So, but obviously the broader world outside of our nerdy cubicles does care about business value and actually operationalizing this stuff. So I believe it's a brewing crisis. I believe there's a lot more awareness growing around this, including surveys that I participated in running, as well as others, industry research. But it's so far largely drowned out by the hype because, you know, organization and anybody
has to do it. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, it's like, well, we're using the very best technology. And yeah, you are, but that doesn't mean you're actually realizing
that. Yeah. So let's step back for a second, because I do want to frame for today that we want to talk about AI and ML. And we want to talk about it in the application, you know, in a way that we can apply it. And particularly about it reminding me of when I started 30 years ago in OD and how, you know, we were talking about change management, and this is another change management problem, I think. So I definitely want to get your opinion about that too. But let's start with one thing. What's the difference between AI and machine learning? I think that people get that confused, and I think it'd be good for you to start with that.
Well, as I mentioned, machine learning is learning from data to predict. Yep. It's a very concrete, well-defined category of technology. There's a lot of different particular methods, but they all do the main thing. They derive a predictive model from examples, and that model serves to make predictions for each individual human, customer, client, voter, healthcare patient, or individual corporate client for B2B. Train wheel that might malfunction, satellite that might run out of battery, or location you might drill for oil. So at that level of detail, organizational unit, it's well-defined. AI is very much not
bigger.
Well-defined. It's it's probably bigger. Depends on how you want it, almost always. But you can define it however you want because there is no concrete definition. It's totally subjective. The word intelligence is subjective. In my opinion, it is nothing but a human term. It describes humans. So it becomes a problem when you try to ascribe the term to machines. And it's amorphous and constantly changing. Over the last year and a half, it's very much become largely synonymous with generative AI, like large language models and other types of use of machine learning to generate image. And it's creating new content pieces. So it can be writing. Can be code, it can be an image, it can be video. And that's what the word generative means. So that's a particular way of using machine learning, where instead of predicting for each customer, for example, you're predicting for each, what should the next word or something on that level of detail be while I'm writing? Well, how should I change this one pixel as the machine is iteratively generating this image? It's still the same underlying type of technology. It's just being applied in a very different way. So right now, AI largely means that, but again, it depends on context. It's also not generally distinguished explicitly from AGI, which is the very popular narrative that we're headed towards artificial general intelligence, machines capable of anything a person can. So let's call that what it is, an artificial human. And I do not believe that we're headed in that direction actively. I don't mean that it's theoretically impossible, but I believe that the narrative is far overblown, and that as incredibly seemingly human-like as we have machines and the amazing advent of generative AI, that does not represent necessarily concrete right. evidence that we right. have taken steps towards artificial humans.
Well, and which is important, because I think that people get concerned and scared about, you know, the robots are going to take over. And certainly there's issues ethically around AI war and combat, things like that. But the fact is that, you know, general AI is far away. So we have to just at AI as something that can help us rather than like it's going to hinder us. So we will get to that in a second. But let's get through. You've got the book, AI Playbook, and you talk about 6-step process to deploy machine learning, and you particularly call it BizML, which I like a lot. So take us through that process, and we can I'll riff on that a little bit as you're going through.
Yeah, so BizML, B-I-Z-M-L, the business practice for running machine learning projects. So it's a organizational practice, right? This is a human practice.
Yep.
Not one of the many technical solutions like ML ops and this kind of thing. In fact, it's also the domain for the book's website, bizml.com. What a coincidence. I worked really hard to coin this new, and I've never tried to coin a buzzword before. It's these 5 magical letters. Because I believe we need to have a general understanding, not only among techies, but among business professionals, that machine learning projects do require a very particular specialized practice, paradigm, procedure, playbook that needs to be followed in order to actually plan rigorously, so that when you get to that culminating step of deploying the model, integrating its predictions, operationalizing them so they change and thereby improve operations, that it actually, the organization's ready for that. There's enough buy-in and understanding of it, and it does get integrated in that way, so that you actually not just generate potential value, but you actually capture that value. So, you know, the 6 steps start with planning for the deployment, the concrete plan. That's step 1. Step 6 is the deployment itself. You do need to continue to monitor and refresh models thereafter. But the way I wanted to frame it was in terms of, let's at least get there. Let's get to the point where it's plausible that this thing is not just going to be number crunched, but actually integrated. And it is very much a change management challenge. It requires change management, which tends to be overlooked, the need for change management, because it's considered a tech project.
It's usual. All technology change is a change management project, all of it, since day 1. And we freaking failed to see that, but go ahead.
Well, there are other kinds of technologies where you can kind of throw the requirements over a wall and say, hey techies, you know, reinstall this new better database system, so now all my database accesses are going to be faster, right? And then the way the thing operates and how it serves the business might change little to nothing. So this is not that. A machine learning project is a consulting gig. It's not a technology install. So it's a change to the fundamental way you're running any and all potentially of your large scale if you want to improve your large scale operations, this, you know, and to differentiate from generative, let's call it predictive AI or predictive analytics, title of my first book, if you want to, or just call it enterprise machine learning, whatever you want to call it. Since we're using predictions to change operations, that means, in addition to the number crunching, we're making an actual change to the very largest scale. The largest scale operations were in marketing, fraud detection, credit scoring. That's where the greatest opportunities are. But that also, the only way you're going to realize value is by actually changing them accordingly.
Right.
So the semi-technical understanding, it's basically just 3 things that people need to get a grip on. And I'll list these 3 things because they directly inform how we break down the 6 steps of the BizML playbook. And they are, for any given project, you need to understand what's predicted, how well, and what's done about it. So what's predicted and what's done about it, that pair defines the use case, the value proposition. Who's going to respond to this marketing? Then contact them. which transaction is most likely to be fraudulent, block or audit that transaction. Which satellite's most likely to run out of battery, investigate to find out whether, you know, we have to change the battery, charge it, or whatever it is. So just large scale operations are made of many, many decisions. And the holy grail for driving decisions is predictions. So that also speaks to just how incredibly widely applicable this technology is. I mean, Harvard Business Review calls it the most important general purpose technology of the centuries. I think that might be the exact quote. So we need to understand concretely what's predicted, and you need to get really detailed about that. You can't just say, I'm going to predict which customer is going to cancel. The business leaders and business pragmatics need to get involved in and inform the full definition of what's often a yes-no question. Which will the customer, among customers who've been around at least 3 months, decrease their spend by 80% in the next time window of 3 months and not increase their spend accordingly on another channel because that doesn't count as of the loss of customer, et cetera, et cetera. All the caveats and qualifiers. So that's the level of semi-technical detail. It's not the rocket science. It's about how to aim the rocket. It's not how a car, how internal combustion works, but it's how to drive a car, which does require a lot of expertise. So that's
what's
predicted. What's done about it, what that comes down to is integrating probabilities into your process, which largely comes down to oftentimes, where do you draw the line? I just published an article in Forbes yesterday about what's called the decision threshold. And in it, once you've developed the model, you have to pick one number that differentiates between the yeses and nos, those that get treated or get operated on, you know, whether you literally operate on a healthcare patient, contact this customer with marketing, audit this transactions fraud. That decision, well, where do you draw the line? Do you only accept credit applications who are 95% likely to pay back, or is 90% okay, right? There's a lot of ranges of possibilities, and that makes all the difference in the world as far as the behavior of what the model is going to do and the bottom line impact that you're going to get. So, and that comes to the second of these three, which is how well does it predict? So what's the performance? This is sort of an elephant in the room, in my opinion. In AI discussions in general, we don't really hear too much about how good is it, right? How good, what are the concrete metrics, the concrete quantitative assessment of how well the thing performs and what that means in terms of KPIs, the actual business metrics like profit and savings, number of customers saved, and how much it increases those. So those, again, those are the three. What's predicted, how well, what's done about it. And they actually compose, not in that order, the first three steps, which are basically-
Okay, that was my question.
Those are the three, the three pre-production steps while everyone gets on the same page and makes decisions.
So before deployment, what's after? So what's after those three steps? Let me get this thing.
Next, the other three steps are the same steps that any data scientist is well aware of for the last like 50 years, like since the 60s, when we use regression for targeting, marketing, and credit scoring. Prepare the data, train the model, and then deploy it. So the data needs to consist of a bunch of positive and negative examples of whatever you're trying to predict. It needs to be often in just a tabular form, very straightforward, simple concept, not easy to actually pull, depending on what your data looks like now. Train the model. That's the core rocket science. That's where that's the whole point, right? We're trying to leverage that technology, which has the ability to learn from data, right? And it might end up outputting a bunch of business rules, which most often are in the form of what's called a decision tree, or a more opaque, intricate mathematical formula, most commonly a neural network, which is just a way to represent a very complex mathematical formula. So that's the kind of core rocket science. And it's fascinating stuff. But my book has that as step five, therefore chapter five, therefore towards the end of a book. It's a machine learning book that doesn't get to the machine learning part towards the end. So I put together a very accessible overview chapter of why the science is so cool and basically how it works. I think there's no reason everyone shouldn't I mean, we learn about internal combustion. This is, you know, at least as cool as that. And then yes. Step six is the actual deployment.
The deployment. So you've mentioned a couple of examples, which I appreciate a lot. Could you go down kind of a little deeper into one of the examples, maybe with a client you've had? I mean, that's obviously not confidential, in terms of how, you know, using the model and how you've been able to deploy an ML project, if you will. Can you just get an example for us?
Sure. I mean, the book focuses on a few select examples. UPS and FICO, who were not client projects that I worked on, and then a couple unnamed, one's named and one's not named, prominent.coms. One is a failure story and the other is a success story where I made models that target ad selection. But the leading example in the book is UPS, which improves their delivery of packages by predicting tomorrow's deliveries. And it's a really dramatic story that really illustrates the challenges, fighting that change management challenge of changing a company that's yes. now more than 100 years old, that's set in its ways, and how prediction is really a key central ingredient to improving the efficiency of such a huge process. So should I get into that story a little bit detailed?
Yeah, that'd be great. You know, like a couple of minutes. Yeah. I think it'd be good for people to hear kind of the process.
So you said a couple hours, is that what you said?
A couple of minutes.
Oh, okay. All right, I'll do the 2 minute version. So you know, what it does is it predicts every shipping center predicts where there will be deliveries tomorrow. So this is for optimizing the last mile, or literally the more last several miles of delivery from the shipping center in a truck to its end destination. The thing is, any shipping center, let's say they have 50 trucks and, you know, 1,000 packages that are going to get delivered tomorrow, they have to decide exactly which packages to put in the truck and finish loading the truck overnight. So the early morning departures for their 1 day expedition, right. Each truck has a relatively optimal route, relatively dense with deliveries, not too much time or driving miles driven. So the problem is there's this lack of information in the late afternoon or early evening when they have to start planning and then actually packing the trucks. They have incomplete information. They don't necessarily know all the packages tomorrow. Some might not have arrived at the shipping center yet. Some might not be tracked for various reasons, depending on time zone. Other ones haven't even been entered in the system on the other coast or what have you.
There's redeliveries.
Yeah. So there's so many things they can't necessarily anticipate. So they've got the known packages that are physically in their hands and are in their system. And then they augment that with tentatively presumed predicted delivery destinations for tomorrow. And now they have a more complete view and use that for their relatively complex system that's now has a better, more complete caseload to work with as far as making those assignments. When all's said and done, when the trucks leave in the morning, some of those predicted deliveries will never have turned out to exist, but that's okay. The fact is now it's done a much better job because a lot of those predictions were very much correct. And the bottom line improvement is very dramatic when combined with prescribing driving directions, which was new at an earlier stage of this project. You know, it's one thing to say, hey, we've chosen just the right packages, so this truck potentially could have a very optimal driving route. That doesn't mean it will actually drive optimally. It depends on the driver. But when they start prescribing the driving directions on top of this system, the bottom line results is that today UPS saves 185 million miles of driving a year, $350 million, 8 million gallons of fuel, and 185,000 metric tons of emissions.
Wow. And are they, what are they using? Are they using Google Map? Is it their own?
Last I knew it was their own, but I don't know what they use up to the day now. So,
okay.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I think we've all had that experience, right? You say, oh, I should have followed the Waze or the whatever the GPS app you're using. I should have used it instead of double guessing it. That's right. Turned out to pan out for UPS.
Interesting. So let's get back to this idea of change management, because as I said, I believe that this is another example of it. And so much of it is about people resisting the change. So how in your model and how in your consulting do you work on that in terms of working with people inside the organization to ensure that the people are open to the change, whatever the change might be?
Well, the biggest thing I've done to try to do that is write this book to try to hammer, because I feel like the story just keeps happening over and over. And I certainly had it, especially early in my consulting. So I had gay.com, which was an online dating site. It was by far the most popular site for gay males. And they were losing a lot of customers. They had a very high churn rate of in terms of the premium level paying customers. So I convinced them to continue a contract. I'd been doing some simpler number crunching for them and be like, look, you should use a churn model and you can, you know, it can more effectively retain customers by predicting which ones are going to leave. So they're like, okay, that sounds like a good idea. But then when I presented it, you know, the power stuck in PowerPoint, and it was the most cliche. Nowadays, it looks like the most cliche thing, not that it's slowing down as quickly as it should. But I presented it in PowerPoint. I'm like, this is what, here's what part of the model looks like. This is how well it predicts. And this is my estimate of how much improvement in lifetime value and what the, you know, you could save a million. You could basically gain another $1 million a year if you act on this. And they're like, what? You want us to do something? You want us to run a new marketing campaign for retention? You know, we're too busy. We don't, that sounds nice. Thanks for the help. And I take the blame at this point, because it's not just that my job was the number crunching. I sold them on the project, but I led with the technology, which is the greatest awesome technology, rather than leading, you know, reframing it as a operations improvement project that uses this technology, but this is an operation. Let's talk about the operations going to be and the change thereof, or in that case, an entirely new marketing campaign for targeting for retention. You know, the main message I have about change management isn't that I have any new or fresh take on exactly how to manage change, but rather do it. Do change management. Don't consider it just a technology project. Realize that this is a business project and it requires change. And yeah, you're going to be using the coolest, awesomest, most generally applicable technology as part of it. And that's a necessary ingredient, but that's not the end all be all. It's not a panacea. Right. It's just a necessary ingredient. So let me just quickly outline how UPS did their change management. After they deployed, they were not seeing the returns as they were hoping. And they did a relative, so the leader of the project is Jack Levis. And he and his team did a relatively good job at really anticipating what it would mean to deploy this and get change into place, but not quite as good at first, they realized, as needed. And they needed to really follow through on the swing. So what they did was they doubled down on their system and were like, look, you have to follow these prescribed directions. People loading the trucks would be like, oh, I know these addresses. I'm familiar with the neighborhoods.
Right.
These trackers definitely go together, and they would override the system much more often than they really should. So at first there's this question of, well, should we be heavy-handed? You know, do we have a strict rule of law? And they literally would sometimes move staffers to a place where they were not familiar with the addresses to get them just follow the rules. But the bigger initiative was more about aligning incentives. So they just set up a scorecard that was led with, that would rate on leading indicators. So not the bottom line that they were looking for, but at least showing compliance. And they kind of aligned the incentives, kind of gamified it in that way, and had a national training staff that grew up to 700 people in total, who would stay on site for more weeks, extra time, keep it going, make sure that they didn't just think it was a novel thing for a couple of weeks and go back to their ways, but rather actually stick to
Interesting.
It. So by following through in all these ways, that's how they got the project to stick.
Neat. So I have a question about the biggest mistake you see companies make. And I'm going to probably guess that it's the change management piece. That's the biggest mistake, or is there something else?
Yeah, it's to jump into the number crunching before there's clear buy-in and an organizational process in place. And it's just, that's almost the norm, right? I mean, you have these relatively unusual leaders like Jack Levis at UPS. And you've got big tech who a lot of their projects are done really well. Financial services does well. I mean, there's places where there's an established process because it's really become the norm for credit scoring, for fraud detection, for large organizations, for targeting ads. But anytime you're kind of in an organization that's doing for the first time or doing something new, you just tend to be falling back into this pattern repeatedly, as if the technology is going to do it for you. These models aren't going to deploy themselves. So there's this, I mean, all I can do is beat a dead horse, right? It's like,
we're going to change
operations. So,
right. I've been studying AI. I mean, I'm not using it so much as I am studying the ethics of it, and went to an AI and responsibility conference back in Oslo, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. So that's my main focus. So I want to hear from you on, especially when it comes to these projects, is there any ethics involved that you're concerned about? It seems pretty like, geez, as you said, it's like an amazing technology as long as the people can understand it's a change management project. But are there any things you're running into in terms of ethics issues?
Yeah, with these types of predictive applications, I'm very concerned about the unequal treatment of different protected groups. And I've been taking that seriously for a dozen years at least. I mean, my first book, chapter 2, is on the topic, and that goes back, first edition was 11 years ago. I've published 12 op-eds in San Francisco Chronicle, Scientific American blog, and elsewhere, and they're all available at civilrightsdata.com. So they go civilrightsdata.com, and you'll see a few videos that help kind of exemplify some of the technical points in those articles, and then the 12 articles themselves. They're just all linked on a list there.
Great, that's awesome.
So, you know, with these types of use cases, we don't have clairvoyance and we can't expect computers to either. It's about predicting better than guessing. So it's going to make a lot of errors, just like a human. It's just potentially going to make a lot fewer, and in some ways maybe less biased than a human, for sure.
Yeah.
But in another way, it ends up reflecting reality and the state of the world, which is a reflection of historical injustices. So, you know, predicting who's going to click, buy, lie, or die, commit an act of fraud, or be a bad debtor, right? We don't have a magic crystal ball. It's going to predict better than guessing, and that generally is more than sufficient to drive a tremendous improvement to the bottom line. We're playing the business is a numbers game, and now you're tipping the odds even just a bit in your favor, and it turns out to have a dramatic improvement on KPIs. So, however, that means it's just like a human, and maybe less often, but just like a human, it's going to make unfortunate errors. So somebody's denied credit, but they probably deserved it. Somebody's going to be denied parole, but they probably deserved it. So the problem is when those costly errors happen with higher frequency for one protected group than another. And the most famous article that's very often cited in ProPublica is called Machine Bias. And it's about the predictive policing example. And it's showing that black male convicts get those types of false positive costly errors at a twice the rate as white male convicts. That's the bottom line. And it's hard to understand. It's sort of a technical point. So one of my videos, one of my articles takes another pass at that issue, which doesn't just apply for predictive policing, right? It applies for credit. You know, when you're deploying these models, you're not just number crunching and optimizing business. you're regulating. You can think of the model that makes these predictions that directly drive decisions as a policy. So it's learning from data to make a policy generator. But if you do that without concern for these types of social justice concerns, right? If you're only optimizing for one bottom line KPI, that's where things go terribly wrong, but that is relatively the norm.
Right. Do you think that somebody on the staff, and one of the people has a question about staff in general, but I'm going to ask a more specific question. I mean, should there be an emphasis on staff in every company, or you want to call something else, something different?
I mean, I should be prepared for that question. I feel like maybe I haven't thought it through. It's part of me just thinks okay. everyone should care about ethics, because I was just hearing.
I know. I get it.
Was it it was Scott Galloway, I think, was just saying on his podcast, we don't need these as separate positions. Everyone should be aware of the ethics.
Yeah. I agree.
So I don't know.
However, all right, let me get to these questions. I like them. Let me see. So Steve asked, I haven't read the AI playbook. What are the key plays in the book that are needed for success? Thank you so much. So beyond those six steps we talked about, what else can we add to that?
Well, the plays are success. The plays is just the six steps, plan the deployment and then execute on the project. Basically, it breaks that down. I think the more important and significant broader mission of the book before that is that semi-technical ramp up. And without that, business stakeholders are not going to be able to participate in detail, but they shouldn't be intimidated. Now, it's not an hour talk. It is a book's worth. And that's the intention of my book. But it's also not the rocket science. So drawing an analogy to driving a car, right? I don't know very much about engines. I have no idea where the spark plug is. And I popped the hood of my car once and I looked in and I was like, cool, look at all that, looks fancy, look at all the parts, right? But I am an expert, just like most people listening, in driving a car. I know momentum and friction, the rules of the road, mutual expectations of drivers, how the car operates. That's real expertise, and you analogously need that kind of expertise to drive a machine learning project so that it succeeds. And that's only possible by deep collaboration where the business side people have ramped up on this semi-technical understanding involving what's predicted, how well, and what's done about it. So, that what's done about it part is really key. I mean, that's metrics. It's just arithmetic. But it's very particular arithmetic, and it's generally not unearthed. In fact, data scientists tend to only report on the performance of models with what I call technical metrics. So precision recall, the most famous, or perhaps the most popular one, is called AUC, Area Under the Receiver Operating Characteristic Curve, right? And they report on these things proudly and say, look how good my model is and how secure we are in its performance. The thing is those metrics don't tell you anything about the business value, the profit that would be delivered depending on how you deploy the model, or the savings, or the ROI, or any of these very direct, straightforward, that's business speak. And data scientists don't speak it. They haven't been trained. I mean, sure, they do in a way, but they don't know how to translate from the model. It's a change that I believe is nigh, I think part of the confusion is these technical metrics really do tell you something. They say, hey, look, this model definitely predicts better than guessing. They only tell you the relative performance comparison to, say, a baseline like random guessing or some other basis for comparison. They don't tell you the absolute business value you would get depending on whether and how you deploy the model. So that translation, that's what step three, determine what the metrics are, both the technical and business metrics that are pertinent. Make sure everyone understands, get everyone on the same page corresponding to step three. Chapter three of the book is on the metrics, makes that point, excerpted recently a Sloan Management Review article where I'm like, look, as an industry, we got to move from these technical metrics that are arcane to also including business metrics.
Okay. Let me get a few more questions. They're coming in now, furiously, fast and furious here. Okay. So I already asked about the staff roles you recommend to conduct a machine learning project for consumer-facing software. Are there any differences from a typical team?
Sure. I mean, there's the terminology is constantly changing. You know, you've got the person who makes the model, and that's often a data scientist. I mean, often has the title data scientist. Data scientist is a very broadly used term, so it's pretty subjective. It's also redundant, by the way, data science. It's like saying I'm a book librarian, you know, it's like, but anyway, that's the trendy term. There's data engineers, and they have more to do with getting the data pipelines ready. And I also just published an article like yesterday in Big Data. I don't have it in front of me. But if you go to my LinkedIn, you'll see I've posted about it. And that's about the data disconnect, where you have data scientists create these features, these inputs to the models, and they're not necessarily easy to recreate on the fly when you're actually deploying the model. So it can be a really big hindrance if you don't plan actively for that deployment from the get-go.
Got it.
And then there's another one, analytics translator. I don't have it in front of me, but there's a list of like five synonyms and everyone's calling it something else. But that's the person who kind of sits in the middle and tries to do the translation that I'm talking about. We might not need that as much if we got the business stakeholders to ramp up on what right. I believe should be standard learning material. Those basic, a concrete understanding of those three things, what's predicted, what's how well, and what's done about it.
Okay, this is a wholly, thank you. This is a whole different question from Douglas. How can AI voice applications like VAPI.AI be used to help with role play and coaching in organizations? Wow, okay.
Well, I mean, that I don't know that company, and I'm not sure what voice, is that a voice application on top of a large language model? I mean, we've done very little talking about generative AI today. And I'm glad to talk about that in general, if you'd like, right? So I've been focusing on what you could call predictive AI to distinguish. Now, early this month, I published in Forbes an article listing three reasons why predictive AI is very often potentially more valuable than generative AI. Predictive AI is where you turn to improve your existing large-scale operations and often has much higher potential returns,
right.
Much more potency to actually be autonomous, whereas generative generally needs a human very much in the loop no matter what to proofread.
It's more tasky. It's more tasky than ML. Yeah. BizML is more about operations. So I mean, that's a very simple different difference, but... Yeah, but go ahead. Is there any thoughts about this idea?
They're kind of apples and oranges, and so it depends on your particular
right.
project needs. But I can't speak to this because I'm not sure what kind of voice applications he means, and I'm not familiar with that company.
Okay. Here's another question. What are the top two red flags you've seen that create risk to machine learning projects and you'd consider not doing a project for whatever reason?
Did it say predictive AI projects? What?
It says machine learning projects. Oh. Yes.
If we're talking here about ethical concerns, I'm not sure there's any absolute. If there's potential value, there's usually also a way to address the ethical concerns in terms of bias mm-hmm. and discrimination that I was referring mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. The question is whether the organization will be willing to adopt it, because it does bring up a contentious issue. If a minority group is receiving a higher proportion of those costly errors, which are usually called false positives, and they're getting essentially penalized by those more frequently, this can take place even if the model, and generally this is the case, does not incorporate the protected class such as race or gender. So it's not an input, it's not taking it directly into consideration, but there are a lot of other proxies, a lot of other things correlate or associate with it. So it's still gonna, you know, neighborhood or whatever it is, history of crime, history of job experience, whatever it is. So it's still gonna show this correlation. And if you want to sort of even out what I consider a symptom of historical injustice continuing to manifest today, the only way to do it is to reintroduce that protected class, such as race, and adjust for it. That is to say, something analogous to affirmative action. So I believe it's a huge opportunity right now, because you see, you can quantify and put in a spotlight on what the injustice is, right? Much more so than when it's inside the black box of a human mind and you don't know the basis of your decisions. And you're not necessarily tracking the data the same as you are with these types of analytics projects. So we've got the spotlight on it, and we have the infrastructure to actually deploy something that adjusts for that unfairness. Because if we're deploying the model, then we're putting, you know, we're using math and probabilities to actually inform or change decisions and processes. So use that exact platform to now do something that also adjusts in a way that tries to address for these inequities. But it means that the only way to do it is to reintroduce the protected class. So it's an analogous affirmative action. This is the basis on which I'm actually for that type of affirmative action movement. But it is a contentious issue. So if your organization is not going to do it, then maybe that's the answer to the question. Then maybe don't do the project at all.
Okay, great. Wow. Thanks everybody for those questions. Appreciate it. And Eric, thank you so much. We're at our time, which I can't believe. Let me just get some of your website information on here. So it's Eric Siegel, PhD. The websites are predictiveanalyticsworld.com and machinelearningtimes.com. You can find Eric on LinkedIn under Predictive Analytics. And of course, the new book is The AI Playbook, Mastering the Rare Art of Machine Learning Deployment. So again, I appreciate so much you being with me and us, and it's been great. Eric, thanks again, waving to you in Marin, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you. Thanks, Sue. Thanks, everybody.
Sure. Thanks, everybody. Bye now.